Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. The Alma Performing Arts Center presents entertainer Soji Tabuchi with Celebrating Christmas with Branson Pizzazz, Thursday, December 19th at 7:30 p.m. This Branson production is known for its festive and talented musicians, singers, and dancers. Tickets and more information available at almapac.org. or 632-2129.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grahaden.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And this is our end of year fundraiser, on-air fundraiser, when we come to you, our listeners, encouraging you to make a contribution if you haven't yet in 2013, or if you have, maybe add a little bit more. One of the biggest motivations behind this fundraiser is we are losing $66,000 in federal funding because of our growth. We no longer qualify as a rural station, so we no longer are eligible for that grant money that we had been receiving. So to help us make up the difference, we hope that generous listeners and contributors like yourself will help us make that $26,000 up. So you can do so now by going to our website, supportkuaf.com, and making your financial pledge there.
You have your favorite causes, organizations, and charities. You support them with your time, your energy, and your money. Chances are you've heard us talk about that cause, organization, or charity on KUAF. Every day we devote airtime to reading public service announcements, and 6 days a week, right here on Ozarks at Large, we produce stories about people in our community working to make this a better place for everybody. Whether it's a change in name for the Kendrick Fincher Hydration for Life or a fundraiser for the Ozark Literacy Council, we think informing you about the important work done in this community is a vital part of our mission at KUAF. We hope you think KUAF is also an important part of the community. We know you are very important to us because you and listeners just like you are the single biggest source of financial support we have. Please pledge online right now at supportkuaf.com, and thank you.
And the reason we come to you, listeners, is because we have to pay for the programming that you hear. You know, we have to write a check to National Public Radio for
NPR,
for Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and we have to write checks to other organizations for the shows you hear on the weekend, like This American Life and Prairie Home Companion.
And Ozarks at Large costs money, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It does cost to staff the show so that we have enough reporters to cover all of the events happening in our area. If these are important things to you, please make your contribution online now at supportkuaf.com. And thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large. Commentary is, of course, nothing new, but the rise of social media is providing more people the chance to create more commentary faster than ever before. If you don't believe me, just do a quick survey of Facebook or Twitter from the past couple of days to see if anybody has had an opinion about school closings, street clearings, or weather forecasting. Devin Powers, an assistant professor of communication at Drexel University, thinks this almost instant style of commentary is changing how we talk, how we live, and how we think. She was on the University of Arkansas campus last month to deliver a speech, and while here, she talked to me about her research into what she calls the commentary economy.
Well, I'm looking at the ways that commentary has become so ingrained into our media ecology. And by doing that, it has also been monetized. So I'm really interested in the ways people use, in the ways websites or services like Twitter or Facebook use our own sort of user-generated commentary as content.
And so monetized, if there is discussion or commentary that's on social media, that is monetized?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's monetized because it helps to keep people in the conversation, right? It helps people to return back. And we all know that clicks are very important and engagement is very important, right? But it's also the content that sort of populates a property. So there are, if you think about something like TripAdvisor or Yelp, that is completely driven by, you know, the interests of regular people to just go on and express their opinion.
Well, money changes everything. So is money changing commentary or...
I believe that it is. in lots of different ways. I mean, New York State recently is investigating services like Yelp because of the ways in which those reviews can so easily be manipulated. You know, there are companies out there that pay people through like services like Mechanical Turks to actually go on and write positive reviews, or there's algorithmically generated reviews, all to give 5 stars to this restaurant or 1 star to a competitor. So absolutely, money is changing the game.
So that's for restaurants or for some sort of other commercial enterprise. Is it changing the commentary that might deal with social discourse?
I absolutely think that it is, too. I think that if you look at social discourse, so much of it is reactive, mm-hmm. right? And the reaction matters more, almost more than what's said sort of in the reaction. And by that, I mean, you know, if you think about the kinds of arguments that people can get into on Twitter and the kinds of mean, acrid things that can go back and forth, that's all about just getting your voice out there. And it's less about sort of saying something substantive.
So, and I don't know if this is an example that works, so bear with me if mm-hmm. it doesn't. But after the most recent Miss America pageant, mm-hmm. a woman who was born in Syracuse, New York, but has Indian heritage, immediately after that, some of the worst things I've seen on Facebook and Twitter start happening.
Absolutely. I mean,
and most of what I'm seeing is horrible things that are being retweeted by people who want me to see these horrible things, not because they agree, but they want me to know that these things are being said. Now, that's sort of a shift. Is that something that kind of lines up with what you're talking about?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And the thing about an instance like that is that when you retweet something, that's a retweet for that person. And it's a retweet whether you endorse what they've said or whether you don't. But I think that the thing about internet ecology is that it doesn't acknowledge necessarily always the motivation behind a reaction. It just acknowledges the reaction. And a click is a click, a like is a like, a retweet is a retweet. They're all equivalent no matter how we feel about it.
So let's say I tweet something that's offensive to a big number of people. Pick whomever. Mm-hmm. And it gets retweeted by people who both agree and disagree. What does that mean then? Who's looking at those retweets? Say it gets retweeted 10,000 times.
Mm-hmm. I think lots of people are looking at them and seeing them. So that's publicity for you. And my guess is no matter what the content of what you said or no matter how many people you offended, your number of followers would probably go up.
So if I am a political commentator for a cable news network or I write a syndicated column or I have a website, that's what I want.
Absolutely. You want to upset people.
Right. We're not necessarily using critical thinking to look behind the curtain.
Absolutely.
So do we become more cynical about the commentary we see, I mean, or less or more skeptical or less skeptical? Or
you're saying what's the takeaway
yeah.
here? What do we do?
Yeah.
The thing to me that I think is important is that we think really hard and we have sort of a moment of dialogue, of social or cultural or critical dialogue about what is happening to critique and to commentary. And I think it's the same thing that's been happening to journalism and happening to writing in general, which is the devaluation of those reactions. We always, you know, the internet has given many people a great option and a great opportunity to share their voices and make their voices heard. But in doing that, we've created this cacophony where everyone is trying to get their voices heard all the time. And when that happens, the techniques that people use have to change. And we've seen the techniques skewing in the same direction that the Inquirer uses to get you to pick up that paper in the grocery store aisle. Sensationalism.
I don't want to make a jump to a conclusion that you don't want to jump to with me, but is it safe to say that general decision-making and discussion, not just on Twitter or Facebook, in the country, is harmed by this sort of polarization?
I absolutely think so. You know, I think that there's a lot of problems with political discourse in this country. They certainly didn't start on Facebook, and they don't end on Facebook. But I think that given how much attention these media have taken up in our lives in a very, very short period of time, I absolutely think that we need to think more about what they do and the corrosive effect that they potentially have on how we communicate with one another. Most of us have probably had the experience of seeing somebody say something on Facebook or getting even into an argument with someone on Facebook and then having kind of a bad feeling about that person afterwards. Regardless, that person could be someone we felt very good about before this exchange, and that can happen without having any real-world interaction with that person, without ever talking to them face-to-face. You just go, oh, I don't like how that person thinks. So I think that that's something I think we need to press the pause button, if we will, a little bit on that. And I hope that by talking about it and acknowledging that we have these kind of effects, that it can have this kind of effects, that we, you know, start to press that pause button a little bit more.
It's so odd because so many things, and I go back to that Miss America example, so many things that were written at that time, I don't think people would say out loud.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems as though there is an element there, and Twitter's not anonymous,
mm-hmm.
and Facebook is not anonymous. But this idea that you can say things that I had not heard spoken by people out loud, and there's part of me that says, okay, good. I kind of want to know that people think these things, that we're, you know, that there's no such thing as this post-racist or post-Zionist mm-hmm. society.
Right. And I think that that's true in some senses. I think that it's good to be aware of sort of the, I hate to use the word evil, but, you know, the sort of difficult and problematic views of the people that are around us. But at the same time, I think we're all probably guilty of having a reaction. You know, whether it's driving down the road and having somebody cut you off and you just have a reaction. And then as soon as you think about it a little bit, that reaction goes away. And I just think that these technologies, they just seize that moment of reaction and they exploit it and they profit from it.
I want to ask you about something else that you have written about at length, and that's rock criticism.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote the book, Writing the Record, The Village Voice, and the Birth of Rock Criticism. Something you mentioned earlier kind of connects to rock criticism. You mentioned in Kanye West and mm-hmm. thinking about why he's doing that and remembering that almost everything has a publicity element behind it. And you write about in that book rock critics having to deal with that too, figuring out when they're doing something just for the sake of the publicist and when they're actually trying to convey a message to potential readers and consumers of music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a battle they've had for some time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that changed over the course of the genesis of rock criticism is that awareness of the of rock criticism as a publicity apparatus. It was not there initially when rock critics started writing about music. It sort of emerged as they figured out that the industry could utilize what they were doing.
Because rock criticism at its earliest stage wasn't taken as seriously as it would be later.
It certainly was not, but it was an exercise in taking both rock and its criticism seriously, and in general also taking the criticism of popular culture more seriously.
What spurred your interest to write that book, Writing the Record, The Village Voice, and the Birth of Rock Criticism?
I was a music critic. That was one of the first jobs that I had. Well, I shouldn't call it a job because I wasn't really getting paid. But when I first moved to New York City after undergrad, I was working at a magazine called Teen People. And in the evenings, I was sort of going and going to shows and writing about it for a website called Pop Matters. And so when I decided to go to graduate school, I was still doing my sort of like daylight or moonlighting as a freelancer, and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write my dissertation on. And at some point, those two things converged, and I decided that this thing that I was doing recreationally and semi-professionally was something that also had intellectual merit.
So when you're writing a record review, if we can still call them record reviews, a recorded consumable music review, what do you want to get across to the person who is reading it?
That is a really good question.
Because here's what mm-hmm. I want. I want to know, should I spend my money on it? But that's not always easy to tell me because you don't know what I like and what I don't.
Well, I think that most critics these days would probably say that they have a bias, that they can't listen for everyone. So they can only listen for the people who have a similar taste profile as themselves. So they have sort of two jobs after that point. One is to give an assessment for those people to whom they can speak about the merits of an album. But the second is to sort of discuss the album as a work of art or as a moment of culture or as a political statement. And I think you see sort of different ratios in terms of how critics deal with those two things, but I think most are dealing with those.
Going back to Facebook and Twitter, it's so instant.
Absolutely.
There's no time. Most people, I don't think, take time to really digest what they're saying or what they've read.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's so much to read that sometimes we don't even read it fully before we share it with someone else or before we have a reaction to it. And that's true whether we're talking about music or whether we're talking about some political act in another country or some election or anything, right? We're all probably guilty of having read an article halfway through and then tweeting it.
or sharing it.
I think there are people who don't who read the headline
yeah.
and tweet it and share it.
Yeah.
And sometimes to their embarrassment because the headline does not at all indicate what is in the text.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the way that headlines have gotten are getting written has also changed because of that fact. Right. So if you say, oh, my gosh, Kate Middleton wearing what? People are going to click on that as opposed to Kate Middleton wears a Vera Wang dress.
Right.
That's very boring. We don't want to click on that.
Right. This has got to be altering the very basis of journalism.
It absolutely is. Absolutely. And it's interesting because, you know, we've seen – I love to tell my students that when I was writing and working at magazines, an accomplished magazine writer could earn $4, $4.50, $5 a word. So, you know, if somebody's writing – you know, if you can get a good couple thousand word story placed in a magazine every month, you have a very good living. We are lucky now, you know, there are places now where you have to write, you know, 10,000 words to get a salary of, you know, that's very, very meager. So, and you're, there are also places that pay by click. So, you know, you make a certain base salary, and then if your stories go viral, you know, then you make extra money on top of that, like a bonus. So you can imagine the kinds of things that people produce in order to pay, to play to that economy. And I think that also goes back to this idea of what's an economy that's built on outrage, that's built on commenting on things rather than producing substance.
Right. If you've written a nuanced article about the Affordable Care Act, and you compare prices before and existing conditions, and maybe you show some of the positives and the negatives, but it's a very detailed article. That's probably less likely to get shared as often as someone who says this is the ruination of the world or this is what, you know, vindicates it.
Right. And that's also how it conforms to the pre-existing sort of polarization and opinions that people have. And if we go back to that, you know, that mythical, very nuanced article about the Affordable Care Act, my guess is it's pretty long. Mm-hmm. So who's going to even make it through that article? And it doesn't matter if people make it through or not, because the number of clicks is the determination of how successful it is.
Okay. Very unfair question. How do we change it?
How do we change it? That's a really unfair question. I need to think for like 10 minutes.
Can it be? I mean, it seems like it's just this locomotive that's rolling along. And
I have what are possibly some idealistic views on this. Insofar as I think, and maybe it's not idealism, maybe that's not the right word, but I think that we are in a particular moment right now where there are so many social media websites. There's so many services. There's so many apps. We all have accounts scattered all over the place. And I just have to believe that this moment is anomalous and that we are headed towards something different because people can't keep up. I mean, the number of people, at least people who are around my age, who joined Facebook and now don't really check it, is pretty high. I mean, if just based anecdotally on the people that I know, lots of people don't check their Facebooks that regularly anymore. And I think they do that because they're fatigued. And I think that we still don't yet know how this is all going to shake out in terms of what are going to be the two or three things that we carry forward into the next moment. And we don't know what the next thing coming up is going to be either. So I think once that closes down a little bit and once we're not all constantly checking and reacting and liking and retweeting and doing all of this constantly, then maybe some of this pace will moderate. And that doesn't change the sort of damage that gets done along the way, but I think that it does add a little bit of, you know, a little bit of hope to the situation.
Devin Powers is an assistant professor of communications at Drexel University. She's also a writer and a researcher. She spoke on the University of Arkansas campus last month and during her visit came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. She's also a music critic and has written the book Writing the Record, The Village Voice and the Birth of Rock Criticism. This is Ozarks at Large.